This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with noted attorney Burt Newborn about his new book.
It's called When at Times the Mob is Swayed. Let's see what the similarities are between Adolf Hitler and Donald Trump.
We take a look at Amazon's new surveillance device. It's called Ring, and they're working aggressively with law enforcement.
Boy, if you think we're in trouble with the big spy's eye in the sky, well, now they want to put one on your doorbell.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Trump was elected by about 25% of the eligible voters. Half of the voters who could have voted didn't. He lost the popular election by 3 million votes. Since then, this appalling man has proceeded to aggrandize his power. Backed by large corporations to whom he gave huge tax breaks and for whom he cut regulations, the military, to whom he just gave a $750 billion budget, a Republican Supreme Court, and the right-wing media such as Sinclair Broadcasting and Fox News, he has maintained a steady base of support in the population. Increasingly, a sense of dread has spread across the country. It appears possible that Trump may get reelected. Democracy and the rule of law are increasingly threatened. Joining us today to talk about the nature of the threat and what we can do about it is constitutional lawyer Burt Newborn. He is the former legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union and has argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Attorney Newborn's book, When at Times the Mob is Swayed, has been recently published by the New Press. He is currently the Norman Dorson Professor of Civil Liberties at NYU School of Law.
Professor Burt Newborn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why did you choose the line from a Robert Frost poem, When at Times the Mob is Swayed, as the title for your book?
Well, it's a poem that Frost wrote in 1916 called Something Like a Star. And he was writing it in the midst of the hysteria that surrounded American entry into World War I and the jailing of protesters and the extraordinary overreaction against dissent. And the I took the line from a quatrain in the poem that says, when at times the mob is swayed to carry praise or blame too far, we may choose something like a star to stay our mind on and be stayed. And so he was really urging people to commit to principle, stay with principle, and not allow the mob to push you in one direction or another.
The similarities between fascist dictator Adolf Hitler and President Donald Trump are alarming. You don't equate the two, but you do point out many similarities in the book, and we'd like to discuss that. Is it a misconception to believe that Hitler took power by force?
Oh, absolutely. Germany fell into Hitler's lap like ripe, rotten fruit from a tree. Hitler never obtained more than about 35% in any free election. And he didn't use the army to seize power. What he essentially did was took power as a minority chancellor in 1933, and then between 1933 and 1936 executed a series of rhetorical acts of satanic genius in which he persuaded the German people to let him govern essentially uncontrolled. Now, he used violence. He used the Reichstag fire as an excuse to suppress dissent. So it isn't as though he didn't use violence, but he didn't overthrow the Weimar Republic. It fell into his lap, and it fell into his lap because he was an evil genius at being able to divide people, to create tropes, to create the rhetoric that tore apart the fabric that held the Weimar Republic together.
Let's talk about Trump's bedside reading. It's been reported that Hitler's 1941 collection of speeches, My New Order, was in the drawer next to Trump's bed.
Well, that's what his first wife testified. His first wife at the divorce trial, at Trump's first divorce trial, his first wife testified that he had a copy of my new order on his bedstand. Michael Kennedy, who was her lawyer, corroborated that that's what she said. This is a pattern, of course. Trump has now sealed that testimony. That testimony is now sealed. No one will ever see it. But I saw it before it was sealed. And Michael Kennedy, who was the lawyer, reported it as well. So it's a fact. I mean, he had a copy on. He admits it. He says he didn't read it. It was given to him as a gift, and he just left it on his bedstand.
It's a decoration.
Yeah.
Why and how are our democratic checks and balances being pushed to the brink?
Well, the questions you asked me about comparing Trump and Hitler are really the answer to that, and it's why I wrote the book. I want to be clear. I'm not comparing Trump and Hitler as people. I think it's a mistake to use kind of facile comparison and compare people to Hitler. Hitler was a satanic, evil force that caused more loss, grief, and tragedy than almost anything else I can imagine. And to compare current people with that level of force, in some sense, trivializes it. It trivializes the genocide. It trivializes the massive evil that he did. On the other hand, you can't close your eyes to the fact that what Trump is doing and did in his campaign in 2016 and is doing now is just taking a page out of the book, out of the Hitler's speeches, and using the same tropes. So when I compare the two, I don't compare the two as people, and I don't compare the two as policy. I compare the two as rhetorical actors who understand how to use language and use mass communication to divide people, and by dividing them, gain more power for themselves. For example, one remarkable example is one of the very early speeches that Hitler gave after he became chancellor was a speech in which he complained about something that he called the Lügenpresse, the Lügenpresse. The Lügenpresse was his description of the mainstream press in Germany, all of which was against him and all of which treated him as a buffoon and a ridiculous blowhard, just the way many people treat Trump. He was complaining about that, and he said it's the Lügenpresse, and Lügenpresse translates in two ways. You can translate it two ways. It translates lying press, or it translates fake news. And the fact is, that book on his bedstand, on Trump's bedstand, taught him how to deal with a mainstream press that was attacking him by simply claiming that they were lying. And it's part of an extraordinary and very dangerous notion that Trump shares with Hitler. Hitler wanted to dissolve the idea of objective fact. So he would say that the mainstream press was lying. You can't believe anything he said. Then he attacked his scientists, and the scientists were lying unless science advanced his policies. And he just kept on pounding at the idea that there was no such thing as objective truth. It was only the truth that the people would accept. So everything was grist for a populist jury. And when you think about it, Trump does that all the time. Trump claims that he'll make assertions like how many people attended his inauguration, and he says it was the most in history, when in fact the objective count means that that was not true. But he keeps on repeating it, and he says it's a lie if you don't accept it. He says it's his weather forecasters, the really extraordinarily good scientists in the meteorology folks, said that the hurricane was not going to hit Alabama. Trump said it was going to hit Alabama. And then when it was proved that he was wrong, he forced his scientists to eat their words and say, no, objective truth means nothing. It's what I say that matters. And that's a dangerous trope that he shares with Hitler.
Yeah, alternative facts.
Yeah, and the alternative facts are the facts that the leader says are true and he can persuade enough of the people to buy onto, and all of a sudden, they become true by some sort of magic alchemy. And I'm also glad you asked about the comparison between Hitler and Trump. I was warned not to put that stuff in the book. not threatened, but warned by well-meaning people who said, Bert, if you put that stuff in your book, no one is getting beyond chapter two. Chapter two is where the comparison is. That's all anybody's going to want to talk about. That's all the attention is going to get sucked into that chapter. And in fact, unfortunately, there's some truth to that. What I really urge people to do is get beyond two. The whole reason I wrote chapter two was to tell you why I'm so frightened and to tell you why we have to be so aware of the weaknesses in our institutional structure, because the institutional structure is going to be under pressure from Trump in ways that it's never been under pressure before, because he is such a genius at the kind of divisive communication that he specializes in. And that puts huge pressure on the democratic institutions. The Weimar institutions cracked. Now the question is, will our institutions crack? And I think they won't. But they won't only if we recognize the danger to them and reinforce the institutions.
We're speaking with law professor Bert Newborn, who's just written When at Times the Mob is Swayed.
In addition to rhetorical tropes, there are other points of comparison between Hitler and Trump. For example, it was enlightening to read in your book that Hitler gave out free radios. What was the purpose of that, and how does it compare, if you think it does, to Trump's Twitter activity?
Oh, well, that's a great question, Heidi. There was a breakthrough in 1931 in radio technology. Prior to 1931, radios were big, galumphing things because you had to have huge tubes so that the radios were large. In 1931, in Berlin, there was a breakthrough in miniaturization. You could make small radio tubes and small radios. And the Nazi Party was one of the first to recognize it. In Yad Vashem, in Jerusalem, in the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, there were two innocuous-looking green cubes, green plastic cubes, on tables. You walk past them because they're not very prepossessing. You would walk right past them. I stopped one day and read the card on the table, and the card said, "These are examples of the radios that the Nazi Party gave out in 1932, beginning in 32, in Berlin. And they were free. And there was only one catch. They only received one frequency. And the frequency was Adolf Hitler's voice. And so this was an enormous technological breakthrough where a charismatic leader could speak directly to large numbers of people with no mediating institution. No editorial, no chance to get back. The words left Hitler's mouth and rattled around inside the heads of the people who were listening to those radios. And a steady diet of that every single day from a master puppeteer, I think, began to move people. And I thought to myself, is there a 21st century analog to those green plastic radios? And the 21st century analog, I said, oh my God, it's Trump's Twitter account. Because you have to recognize, he was one of the first to realize that politicians could communicate directly with a mass audience, going around the media, going around the press, speaking directly to the heads of the people who were receiving the information. And I said, that's the analogy. The analogy is the technological breakthrough that enables him to speak directly to 60 million people as though they are in a room with him, just the way Hitler was able to speak to 60 million people. Now, anybody can do it, but the thing that we have to acknowledge is that Hitler was a genius at it, and Trump is pretty damn good at
it.
At least for me, when I put together all the points of comparison, the use of Lügenpresse, the slogan, Hitler ran on a slogan in which he promised to make Germany great again. The slogan and the lying press and the misogyny and the racial dog whistles. I mean, this is a president who has managed to make hurricane aid to Puerto Rico into a race issue because he finds the edge, he finds the racial edge in everything and divides us on that basis. So when you put that kind of similarity together with the technological breakthrough, Then I said to myself, American institutions are going to take a pounding from this like nothing they have ever experienced before. I said, and it's about time for us to give those institutions a stress test to see how well they'll survive. And that's what my book is. My book is a stress test for American institutions and a series of recommendations for how we can reinforce those institutions.
The book is called When at Times the Mob is Swayed by law professor Bert Newborn.
Did both Trump and Hitler help or enable large corporations to cement their rule of power?
Sure. There's a remarkable comparison between Hitler's version of fascism, and fascism generally, but Hitler's version and Mussolini's version of fascism used corporations essentially as de facto governance structures. They actually governed through the delegation of enormous power to corporations, who then exercised that power to order the economy and order the way people worked. And so in a fascist regime, corporations really should be seen as an engine of the state. Volkswagen, for example, was a corporation that was chartered by the Reichstag and actually functioned as an organ of the state. After the Second World War, when reparations were being thought of, it was very complicated to deal with Volkswagen because they didn't know whether it was a private corporation or a government organ. And many, many corporations operated that way. Trump, of course, has, in the modern era, has empowered American corporations more than any other president that I can think about. He showered wealth on them with the tax bill. He's pulled away most of the restrictions that would protect the environment. He is hostile to anything that would protect workers against exploitation. And so we're living in a society now where corporations are empowered create and exercise immense influence over how we live. And, you know, culminating, of course, Trump didn't do this, but the forces that Trump is unleashing did it. The Supreme Court then tells us that corporations can speak, and they have First Amendment rights just like everybody else. I hadn't realized that a corporation was going to move in next to me and just put its arm around me and tell me that it was my friend. I didn't know corporations were people, but the Supreme Court seems to think they're people. And they can speak, and there's no way that you can regulate that. And not only that, in the Hobby Lobby case, They went so far as to say that a corporation has a soul and can exercise religious freedom rights. So you've got corporations praying. You've got corporations, and by the way, praying in two ways, praying to their God and praying on the rest of us. The immense power of the corporate state is something that existed in both Weimar Germany and the United States. Now, again, I want to be very clear. The United States is not Weimar Germany. Weimar had no tradition of democratic governance. Germany, it was very thin. The Weimar Republic was imposed on Germany at the end of the First World War. It's unclear how much support there was for democratic governance in Germany ever during that period. And they were in the midst of the Great Depression. So they were facing massive economic problems. They were facing what was an unfair treaty. The Treaty of Versailles was an unfair treaty, and there was no real democratic tradition in Germany. So Hitler found it relatively easy to push the Weimar Republic over. No one is going to find it easy to push American democracy over.
I wanted just to mention both Hitler and Trump's glorifying the military, but let me ask you this. What about both of these men's attack on the rule of law, on the separation of powers, on the judiciary?
Well, one of the ways that Hitler took power in 1930s was to dissolve the power of parliament. He used the Reichstag fire as an excuse to declare a national emergency, words that Trump has learned very well. He declared a national emergency, seized the power to act unilaterally as the chancellor, and the courts didn't stop him. Once he had done that, by the 1936 Olympics, by the 1936 Berlin Olympics, in 3 years, he had essentially eroded all of Weimar's democratic institutions and all of the protections of separation of powers. One of the things I talk about in my book is the very dangerous response of the Supreme Court to Trump's assertion of the power to act unilaterally. Reasonable people can agree or disagree about whether we have a rational immigration policy. Reasonable people can agree or disagree about whether we need a border wall or whether tariffs should be raised or lowered. I mean, when I think of the substantive policies that Trump is pursuing, those are policies that in a democracy, reasonable people will deal with. But they are policies that should be put into place by Congress, not unilaterally by a president saying it's a national emergency and I get to rule alone. There you're beginning to flirt with real danger. When you begin to give that kind of power to a megalomaniacal person like Trump, who sees the world through his own ego, and you take away all the checks, and the judiciary doesn't respond. They learn a new word called deference, and then they just roll over and let Trump scratch their belly. If that's what we're going to see, that the center-right Republican Party folds up in Congress, Trump then just ignores Congress, and the courts don't stop him, that's a recipe for danger. Now, I don't say it's, you know, I don't say Trump is intending it. I don't think this is what he wants. I don't think he has within his intellectual apparatus. I don't think he has the capacity to think through that way. He thinks it in very short-term things. What's good for me? What gets me the best ratings? What advances my chance of winning in 2020? That's all he's thinking about. But he's running around like a bull in a china shop and knocking over institutions that are designed to protect American democracy.
He's puerile.
Well, I think he's the first two-year-old president. I mean, I remember how my kids acted at two. They would scream until they got their ice cream. And I have a hunch that we have a president who screams until he gets his ice cream.
What about Trump and Hitler's rejection of international norms, like the Paris Climate Accord or the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, that's another similarity between Trump's policies and Hitler's policies. Hitler despised internationalism, probably for good reason. Internationalism is how the Treaty of Versailles took Germany at the end of the First World War and really imposed, I think, dreadfully unfair sanctions on them in a way that eventually caused such resentment that there was a revolution against it. That's the way Trump dealt with international. He thought all international relations were based on power. The power, not on the sort of common good, not on an effort to get together in collective enterprise, but what a single state could do to advance its policies. And he had this vision of a world in which it was a closed pie. Whatever Germany got, somebody else lost. There was no way to get together and make the pie bigger. It was a fixed pie. And Trump behaves that way, too. Trump mistrusts internationalism. Even NATO, which is the most successful international military alliance in world history, he threatened to pull us out. He's constantly denigrating NATO, pulled out of the climate accords, pulled out of the nuclear treaty with Iran. He simply doesn't trust international institutions. He trusts only in American power. Now, we could have a debate about that, about whether that's good foreign policy or bad foreign policy. I happen to think it's dangerous foreign policy. But it's Trump's idea of the world is an embattled America in which the rest of the world is trying to pick our pocket. And what we have to do is lash back out at them, either by raising tariffs and starting a trade war or by increasing militarization to the point we threaten them militarily. But the last thing he'll ever do is compromise with them and try to work out a deal where everybody gets a little bit more.
We just have a few minutes remaining, but we want to talk about your specific proposals to strengthen democracy. In the USA, we don't have one person, one vote.
No.
Why And what would you suggest we
do? We have to come to grips with as a people with the fact that the Constitution is deeply flawed that way. The only way they could get a Constitution in 1787 and 1789 was to make a deal with the devil, and that was to protect slavery and bring the southern states in, or else there would never have been a United States. Part of the deal with the southern states was to promise the southern states that they would have the same representation in the Senate, regardless of population. And so every state gets two senators, doesn't matter how many people there are. And that tilts the political world in the United States toward rural America, sparsely populated rural America, that just happens to be white. So if you take Wyoming with 600,000 people, 97% of whom are white. If you take Wyoming with 600,000 people, Wyoming gets two senators. California, with 40 million people of enormous diversity, also gets two senators. That's a 65-to-1 violation of the one person, one vote. There are many states where it's 20-to-1. New York is more than 20-to-1. California is more than 20-to-1. One person, one vote violation. Pennsylvania, Illinois. The states of urban America are the states that get hurt this way. And it tilts the political system toward rural voters. It gives rural voters more say in the Senate. And that then carries over to give rural voters more say in the Electoral College. Because the Electoral College, the indirect way we elect the president, allocates electors by how many senators and representatives you have. So if you have two senators, you get two electors, even if you don't have any people. So Wyoming has three electors, one representative, two senators, which means that they have a disproportionate amount of power in choosing who the next president is. And that's why, in the 21st century, the Republican Party has lost the popular vote in both 2000 and 2016, but nevertheless elected their candidate. They elected Bush in 2000. They elected Trump in 2016. And 2020, the Republican Party will certainly lose the popular vote. There isn't any question that they will lose the popular vote by millions, but they have a real chance to really win the presidency because Trump can thread the needle with white rural states that will give him enough electoral votes to become the president.
We're speaking with Bert Newborn, who's just written When at Times the Mob is Swayed, an excellent book. We recommend that our listeners get it.
We could go on for another half hour. Unfortunately, we can't. What kind of extra legal resistance do you suggest in the book?
I don't suggest it. I have the final chapter is called Night Sweats. I mean, the body of the book is a series of recommendations about how to increase voter turnout, how to understand how judicial review works, how to get rid of partisan gerrymandering. I mean, all the things that I think many people know we have to do in order to fix the democracy. And then I say, in the end, what if it doesn't work? What if I'm wrong? What if the romantic optimist in me turns out to just be wrong? And that's, I call the chapter Night Sweats. And I think through all of the scenarios. Trump loses the 2020 election, but claims that he loses the 2020 election because of undocumented aliens who cast phony votes. And he says he's not going to step aside because that would mean a trashing democracy. And I have in the book, he asks Attorney General Giuliani to engage in an investigation of the election. But he said, until then, I'm not stepping aside. And he just says...
That's what his lawyer said he'd do.
Yeah, well, he threatened it. He threatened it in 2016. I said, what if he actually does it? Or worse, what if he just ran, you know, a kind of befuddled Joe Biden? What if he just takes him into custody? And takes Biden 2 days to figure out he's been taken into custody and just ends the election? What would we do? And the one thing we can't do, the one thing that it is absurd to think about doing, is to resist by violence. That's a trap. It's a trap in which people will die and nothing will happen. That's the left wing's view of the right wing's vision about why they have guns. They claim that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to have guns so that they can defend themselves against the government with hunting rifles. They're going to defend themselves against tanks. It's an absurd view. And it would be equally absurd for the left to think that they can resist violently. But you don't have to resist violently. There are nonviolent resistance mechanisms that I speculate about. This is not going to happen. If you come to my house tonight, I will give you a written promise that this will not happen. That our institutions will hold and that we will never have to do extra legal defense of democracy. But there are mass strikes. There are sit downs. The thing that I think would be the most interesting thing was to harness federalism and to get the states to simply go into resistance to the federal government. For example, suppose the states decided that instead of paying your federal taxes directly to the federal government, you paid your federal taxes to a state office that checked the return for accuracy and then sent the money into the federal government. Well, suppose the money didn't get to the federal government and the states actually began to starve it. I mean, it's one of the extraordinary things that happens in America today. It's the very group that's underrepresented. Urban America is where all the ideas are. It's where the economic engine of the country is. It is what drives the country forward. And that urban America bleeds money to rural America. We essentially finance the lifestyle of the people in rural America who claim that the government is their enemy, when it's in fact it's the only thing that keeps most of them alive. And if that flow of money were ever cut off because we stopped paying taxes for it, you'd be surprised how fast there'd be a change in politics. So and it would depend upon having courageous local and state officials who would step into the breach and attempt to restore democracy. But let me say again, it's not going to happen. It's my science fiction chapter at the end of the chapter.
Bert Newborn, it's been a pleasure for Heidi and I to be able to speak with you today.
How can listeners read what you've...
Oh, well, there's a webpage at NYU, NYU Law School, where I've taught for 48 years now, has a webpage in which the writings of all of the faculty are listed and available. I warn you, there are 82 articles, and once you start, I'll keep tabs of you to make sure that you read every one of them. But you can go to the webpage at NYU and Great. Get free access to virtually
almost everything. And what is that citation?
Google NYU.
Yeah. NYU School of Law.
Yeah.
Bert Newborn, you've written, "When at times the mob is swayed, we urge everybody to go out and get a copy." And Heidi and I thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
When it comes to e-commerce, the multinational tech company Amazon has laid claim to a huge corner of the market. It may surprise some to learn that it's also in the business of surveillance. Amazon aggressively pursues and cultivates law enforcement partnerships. More than 400 police departments across the nation have already joined forces with the tech giant's so-called smart doorbell program, Ring. Part of Amazon's outreach strategy in gaining new police partners is to play on fears of increasing property crime. Ring doesn't just show you who's at your door. It films and records any movement within the local vicinity. It films and records any movement or interaction in the vicinity and then alerts users' phones. with partnerships between corporations and law enforcement to use new surveillance systems in the public, leaving out community input, there come a host of civil liberty concerns, including racial profiling. Joining us to discuss this growing partnership between a mega company and American law enforcement is Matthew Guerilla of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Matthew is a policy analyst working on surveillance and privacy at the local, state, and federal level. He is a frequent contributor to the Freedom of Information-centered outlet, Muckrock, and his bylines have appeared in the Washington Post and Motherboard. Matthew, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Matthew, what is Amazon's Ring, and when did we first start hearing about it?
Well, Amazon's Ring is a smart doorbell camera that people install on their front doors, and it pings your phone whenever it senses movement, motion, or whenever somebody rings their doorbell, and you get a little notification on your phone that allows you to peer through your own Ring camera. The company has been around for a few years, but it didn't really start expanding quickly until it was acquired by Amazon in 2018.
Now, in one of the pieces that you've written, you've called Ring's partnership with U.S. law enforcement, quote, a perfect storm of surveillance. Tell us how that is.
Well, the partnership with police is problematic in a number of ways because what it essentially has created is a CCTV network that, while it doesn't belong to the government, doesn't belong to municipalities, it belongs essentially to Amazon, who are doing everything they can to cooperate with police and make it as easy for them to acquire footage from your doorbell camera without a warrant as possible.
And we want to talk about that in a minute. But first, we understand Amazon has an aggressive outreach campaign to police departments, sometimes offering incentives, I understand. Can you explain how the company is marketing this to police?
That's a very good question. It's very aggressive, as you've mentioned. We know that some tactics have included in the past, like going to large international police conferences and hosting parties there where police chiefs will come and they'll leave with free Ring cameras and they'll get free alcohol and you know, dance the night away with representatives of Ring. But the other operation of this is very aggressive marketing. So you've seen in emails back and forth between Ring and police departments through Freedom of Information Act requests and the reporting on this that show that Ring representatives follow up with police departments very diligently, and they offer them things. Like, so for instance, one of the kind of tenets of these Ring partnerships is municipalities will pay a lot of money to Ring. I've seen anywhere between $25,000 and $100,000. And in exchange for that money, Ring can offer cameras to city residents for a subsidized price. So they aggressively market them, they offer them subsidized cameras for a municipality, but they also offer them, you know, surveillance. What they're offering them is a police interface to the Ring system that allows them to request the footage of Ring users incredibly easy with just the tap of a button. And so if you have a Ring doorbell camera on your front door, what it looks like is an email or a notification on your phone saying your local police department requests the footage between this hour and this hour. Would you like to give it to them? And there's no button in order to not give your footage to police. You just have to ignore the message, which kind of gives the illusion, one, that if you don't do it, you're being a bad citizen, which you're absolutely not, and two, that you kind of don't have a choice. So all of these incentives make police departments much more willing to work with Amazon to try to push Ring in their own cities.
Okay, and I think what you've just mentioned about the silent pressure for people to turn over the video is really the crux of what we want to talk about. I want to clarify first, is Ring's so-called law enforcement neighborhood portal map interface, is that related to what you were just saying about getting requests from law enforcement to turn over video?
Yes. Part of the police's interface with Ring is, you know, there's been a bit of conflicting reporting on this, but from what I understand, whether or not it's created by the police department themselves or handed over to them by Amazon, who, you know, as by virtue of you signing up for Ring, have to give your address and so they can map it, police have, many police departments have maps where they can see where Ring cameras are in their city. And so requesting that camera is as simple as, you know, swiping through a map, seeing the camera that you want to get footage from, and clicking on that camera and requesting the footage. So part of this kind of big network of surveillance is also geographical.
Is the footage stored in the cloud?
Yes. So Amazon has the footage. When you know, when you read the terms of service, you'll see that while you have access to that footage, you can share it to your own social networks, which they encourage you to do through the Ring interface, the Ring app. The footage is very clearly owned, maybe not owned, but is controlled by Amazon in the sense that it is stored on their cloud for 6 weeks before it's deleted. And in the terms of service, you can read that they can pretty much do anything they want with that footage. They can use it for promotional materials, which they have done. They can alter it in any way. They can use it for a lot more purposes than just store it for you.
Now, Matt, just let's pose a hypothetical before Michael chimes in here. If a police department wants to monitor a particular individual, what's to prevent them, and they know that person has a Ring, what's to prevent them from going to Amazon and saying, please do not delete the footage of Jane Doe after the 6 week period?
Unless the police department has a warrant, I'm not sure how that would work. But the thing about these Ring partnerships is if police wanted to monitor a specific person with a Ring camera, there are a lot of ways they could get around doing it than just going to Amazon. So one way would be to get a warrant and to go to Amazon for their footage. You know, it's really unclear at this point whether Amazon has to inform you as an owner of a Ring camera whether or not police have come directly to them with a warrant and are bypassing you entirely. Because in many instances, if police could have approached you and asked for footage, and if you say no, they can just get a warrant and go straight to Amazon. And in that case, even though you've refused the police, they end up with your footage anyway, and you might not even know. And the other way they can do it is just by asking you directly. They can say, listen, you can get a notification. We need your footage for a case. Will you please share it with us? And you could do that, theoretically, unknowing that the case they're working on is an investigation of you yourself.
That's interesting.
So do these people who purchase Ring, what do they think they're getting, and do they have to pay a monthly fee for this?
The Ring cameras themselves cost, you know, between like $150 or $250 or something. And I think there is a monthly fee associated with it, but not everyone has to pay it. I'm not sure how the economics of it work out. I mean, we know that how they make their money on Ring is by selling as many cameras as possible. But what people think they're getting is peace of mind. People, you know, even though research, you know, shows that crime rates are down in most parts of the country, that fear of crime is on the rise. And so while people think they're getting peace of mind, they're installing a security camera on their front door, what they're actually kind of getting is the opposite, because every time, you know, a delivery man comes to your front door, every time a dog walker walks by, you get a notification on your phone because there's motion at your house. Suddenly it seems like your house is under siege. So what people really think they're getting is peace of mind, is a little bit of security for their front stoop, but in actuality they're getting a lot of paranoia. And what they're not thinking about is how all of these cameras are networked together. You're not just watching your own porch, you're helping police and Amazon watch every porch in your neighborhood.
So do guests or delivery people or others know that they're being recorded?
That's a good question. I mean, some people, I think, have little signs like people would with traditional security systems saying this home is watched, you know, is you're on security camera. But until rings become more ubiquitous and people recognize them as security cameras, it's a question of whether or not a person approaching a porch knows they're being filmed. And this raises a lot of, you know, troubling questions for not just for privacy in your neighborhood, but for things like democracy in general. I mean, I don't know how willing some people would be to go door-to-door canvassing for the political candidate of their choice if they know that that interaction is being recorded and could be shared to Facebook with a click of a button.
Matt, you mentioned Freedom of Information Act request earlier, and I wondered if it's true that local governments or police have to run any public comments that they might want to make about Ring by Amazon for approval first. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, this is offered as kind of a perk of the partnership, is that you have Amazon and Ring's communications experts there at your disposal, not just for helping you field questions about the partnership or helping you, you know, in some places push the adoption of Ring in certain neighborhoods, but also to help you as a police department get footage from people. So there's some of their Q&As, some of their resources they have for police departments is helping you best pitch why a certain resident should share their Ring footage with you. But the other side of this relationship is that Ring is really strict about the messaging that goes out to the public about Ring from police departments. And so through some of these, you know, released emails, we've seen Ring actually ask police departments to change press releases that are already out because they don't like some of the certain wording. Or as one article that got a lot of attention a few weeks ago reported, Ring doesn't like police departments to use the word surveillance when they talk about what these cameras are and what this network is.
That's fascinating and really troubling to me.
Yeah, this is really a 1984 scenario, Matt. Why should communities care about Ring coming to their neighborhoods? What's at risk here? I think it's more than what you've already said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things at risk. Apart from just the fact that, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily want to live in a society where they're constantly being, you know, captured on footage that they have no control over and that the camera owner or Amazon or police have access to that footage all the time. The other aspect is, like I said, paranoia. A lot of people are suddenly frightened that their neighborhoods are much more dangerous than they actually are because they're constantly getting notifications that there's a person in the bushes in front of their house when really, who knows, it's somebody delivering a newspaper that went awry. And the other problem with this is it really ends up threatening vulnerable communities in a way that surveillance often does. For instance, I mean, I think I've called it somewhere that Amazon Ring is in some ways a digital superhighway for racial profiling, in the sense that if every person you see walk by your Ring camera is a potential criminal, then a lot of people's, you know, implicit or very real biases about what type of person looks suspicious come to the surface. And it'd be one thing if you're just looking at your own security camera and saying that person looks suspicious. But when you can suddenly share that footage with police, when you can share that footage with everybody in your neighborhood who's on the neighbor's app, suddenly racial profiling gets outsized and can be exported very, very quickly and have real-world consequences.
Matt, are you able to relay the story of the African-American real estate agent who was stopped by police?
Yeah, I mean, this is a story, I don't remember the explicit details, but it was something like an African-American real estate, you know, doing what real estate agents often do, which is walking through a neighborhood and, you know, looking at houses, appraising them, seeing what's on the market, and somebody who had been, you know, in their house had seen this, and through their eyes, because these These apps have conditioned us to see everybody on the street as a potential criminal, and through, you know, obvious racial bias, opened up their app that they communicate with their neighborhood on, and specifically about public safety and crime, and reported what they saw as suspicious, as what looked to be casing a house for later burglary. The cops were eventually called. And this can have the, you know, put people in danger who have done absolutely nothing wrong other than taking a stroll through a neighborhood.
We're speaking with Matthew Guaraglia of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Matthew, has there been any lawsuits regarding Ring brought yet or contemplated?
Not yet, but we're beginning to see a real public pushback against not just Ring, but the type of surveillance that Ring brings into neighborhoods. So with the rise of city ordinances banning facial recognition use by police and governments, for instance, I think we're going to start to see a lot more community backlash to these types of partnerships. But part of the thing that's so nefarious about Ring is that when you buy a Ring to put on your front door to keep your house safe, it's very hard to conceptualize it as part of a large kind of state-accessible surveillance network. And so as people begin to realize that their domestic decisions have big national and at least community-wide implications, I'm hoping we're going to start to see some pushback.
Matt, I'm curious about how Amazon profits from the Ring, and I have an idea that I want to run by you. We know that Amazon and all the other large data aggregators resell demographic information to marketers. I am suspecting that Ring represents a foothold for Amazon to get into law enforcement to possibly start the beginning of a codependent relationship, whereas policing may become more data-driven or technology-driven, like with things like ShotSpotter and equipment like that, that Amazon wants to become a long-term partner for new products like this initial surveillance system. Do you have thoughts about that?
There's no doubt that there's a lot of money to be made by getting into law enforcement and, by extension, kind of military and counterinsurgency and all of those kind of contracts that have, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars at their disposal. And there's no doubt that those types of government agencies are going to be absolutely just scooping up as much kind of face recognition software as they can, cloud storage, things that can, you know, streamline their data analysis. So there's no doubt that that is a big market that Amazon is looking toward. But I think what Amazon is also looking to do is get their foothold in the kind of smart home, smart appliance world in a way that will eventually bring together all of your Amazon products. So not just will your Alexa be linked to your doorbell, but your phone can tell you when the face recognition software on your Ring has detected that your uncle has come over, and then, you know, you can use that to unlock your Amazon smart door or whatever. So I think part of it is about the future of law enforcement and government contracts. But I think also a big part of it is integrating security and surveillance into the larger strategy for an Amazon smart home.
Yeah, it's really creepy. Last month I went to my cardiologist. I live in Brooklyn, and the doctor's in Manhattan. So when I got through with the doctor, I had to drive through the tunnel that goes from Manhattan to Brooklyn, and they take your photograph when you enter the tunnel. So they knew about what my doctor had to say before I even got home. This kind of thing is all interconnected and plenty spooky.
Yeah, I would be really wary in the future of any moves. And we know they have a patent for this. As far as we know, it's not integrated in the U.S. yet. But I would be really wary if Amazon starts making moves to put facial recognition on your Ring cameras, because there are so many hypothetical scenarios, like what happens if your, you know, pizza delivery person has a criminal record, and because they've stepped on your porch, every time they step on a porch with a Ring, police get called just because of their record, even though they're there to do their job. You know, it's going to complicate a lot of people's lives once face recognition gets involved on everybody's front stoop.
The other concern, of course, is with the proliferation of security technology in so-called smart homes, the possibility of being hacked and having all that data not properly protected by Amazon.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime in these days, anytime you have somebody, an entity, collecting massive amounts of very personal data, you have to believe that that data has a bit of a target on it. And you have to wonder how comfortable you'd be with that data getting hacked and getting released out into the world.
Matthew, we're coming to an end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you how our listeners can learn more about your work and the work of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yeah, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation is one of the premier civil liberties organizations in the United States and internationally focused on freedom in the digital world. Specifically, my work revolves around surveillance and privacy, involving all things digital and online. So anybody who is interested in the work, and interested in staying attuned to what's happening with Ring and with face recognition, can go to EFF.org. They can follow our work. They can become a member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and support the work that we're doing here.
We love EFF, Matthew. A final question. How did you become interested in this area?
That's a good question, yeah. I started filing FOIA requests very early on in my college experience, just as a curiosity. I was interested in, you know, the FBI files, the surveillance files of kind of, you know, famous 20th century figures. And as I dove deeper and deeper into the history of surveillance, I began to realize that, you know, with more technology in our lives, surveillance has just gotten more and more prevalent and more ubiquitous. And so ever since then, I've been really engaged in this and fighting the good fight.
Well, Matthew, it's been really thrilling to have you on, eerily so, we must say, and we hope to stay in touch to have you on about other surveillance and civil liberties issues.
And don't worry if you come to my doorstep.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. Anytime.
Great. Have a great day.
Thank you, Matthew.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.